Welcome to Morph Into a New You, part of MHNRnetwork.com. Your host, Johnny Calloway, is the author of several books, including Taming the Dragon, Dragons to Butterflies, The Metamorphosis of a Man, and The Bridge. He will be having conversations with people from all walks of life. Healing really is an inside job that transforms you to become a better version of you. We must change our self-talk and inner dialogue so we can start to believe. A special thanks to our sponsor, Meaningful Expressions, at m-expressions.com. They can take a concept, thought, or personal brand and turn it into a visual masterpiece that you can use to raise awareness about your passion or cause. They've certainly done that with our podcast website. And thank you for joining Johnny as you morph into a new you.
Hello, everybody. This is Johnny Calloway, host of Morph Into a New You, where we believe changing thoughts changes lives. Proud to be a part of Mental Health News Radio Network. And we always want to throw out a thank you to Kristen Walker for producing this for us and providing us with a platform so we can be heard. Well, we have Dr. Eric Gentry with us again today, and we're going to be talking about the hidden benefits of doing a four-step, which is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And what I mean when I say the hidden benefits is, to me, the four-step opens the door to peace. Because if we are truly honest in our four-step, got to be honest, it's nothing without the honesty. But if we're truly honest, then it has to create some level of humility. Because when you're honest with yourself about yourself and you realize that you're not all that in a bag of chips, it's got to lower some of that false sense of pride. And not only that, it opens the door to some compassion and understanding and empathy. Because when you take an honest view of yourself, in my mind, you have to somewhat become a little more understanding of those people that you're usually so quick to judge. So we're going to talk to Eric about that today and see what he can throw in with that. And I can't wait to hear what he's got to say about this. He may shoot me right out of the saddle, right out of the gate. Hey, Eric, how you doing?
Hey, Johnny. I don't shoot anybody out of the saddle anymore. I will endeavor to collaborate and build something that is shared and beautiful between the two of us.
Okie dokie, then. What do you think about that, Eric? What do you think about the hidden benefits of a four-step?
Co-sign everything that you said. Absolutely. And really clear that there's some more, too.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking about it. Just popped into my head while you were talking. A brief little story. When I first got clean, I had been playing music before I got clean. And then after I cleaned up, I started writing recovery music. And, you know, that continued on for 20 years, 15 years. And then I got more and more serious about it. When I moved to Sarasota in 2004, I started playing with some guys. And we got kind of serious about doing recovery music. And in 2012 and 13, recorded in Nashville, a CD. And in 2006, we recorded our first one. And clearly, I was the vocalist. And my vocals were just not up to quality. And a friend of mine, Bud, you may know, suggested that I go work with this vocal coach. And his name is Danny Ellis. And the very first day that I went to work with him, and he completely changed the way I sing, and I have a pretty decent voice today, and it's all due to him. And I went to his house and took my guitar, and he's Irish, he's from Dublin, and he scratched his little beard, and he said, "Play me a song." I wish I could do his brogue. He'd usually say, "Play me a song, lad." So I played him one of my songs. I got done with it, and I looked at him expectantly, and he kept rubbing his chin and nodding his head. And he looked at me straight in the eye, and he said, "You started singing when you were using, didn't you?" He knew I was in recovery. I said, "Yeah, I did." And he said, "I can tell. And the reason why I can tell is what you did is that you crafted a facade. Your singing voice is fake."
Wow.
He said, "It's an interesting facade, and it's pleasant to listen to. But if you're interested in stepping out from behind that facade and learning to sing your song, then it would be a privilege to help you do that."
Wow.
Yeah. And he taught me how to have an authentic voice. He taught me how to, instead of being so afraid about what other people thought about what I was singing, he taught me to get in touch with my heart and my soul and sing from an authentic place. And if the fourth step does anything, that is the first step to, I was thinking about the title of your show, Morph Into a New You. What the fourth step does is it is truly the greatest leap to, instead of becoming a new me, it's becoming me.
Right.
It is becoming myself.
Right.
And you just can't, an addict can't get to themselves except through the gauntlet of the fourth step, I don't believe.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, Miracles in the Teacher's Manual, where it talks about the development of trust, it talks about reaching a bottom. It talks about losing everything, and it talks about that being what we call in the 12-step rooms the gift of desperation. And it truly is a gift, because, and where the fourth step ties into that for me is the pain. The desperation forces me to seek, forces me to search, and that's what we've been doing all along. I looked for it in syringes. I looked for it in the bottom of liquor bottles. I looked for it in the bottom of bags of pot. I looked for it everywhere. The only place I would not look for it was within me. That's where all that seeking for me takes me. It's like, God, please, let me find this. Let me find that. Well, quit looking for it. You got it. It's there all along. Shortly after I quit using, I used to would not leave my house without a baseball cap on my head. It was like it was not happening. And one morning, while I was still married, I got up and my buddy's out in the driveway honking the hell out of his horn, wanting me to come on. We're already late. I'm running all over the house looking for my hat. I go and I wake my wife up. I said, what have you done with my damn hat? And she started laughing. I said, this ain't funny. He's ready to go. She said, it's on your damn head. Now, I'm tying that into this because I spent all that time looking for God or some connection, but I looked for it outside of me. I never found it until I truly looked within. And the pain that drove me to that caused me to searching fearlessly to find. But man, I had to turn over a lot of rocks to come to that conclusion, man. I had to look in a lot of places because I'm one of those people. I never quit doing anything just because it became a good idea. I had to hurt. And okay, and my recovery to a great degree, and I've said this before on the show, has been like playing whack-a-mole at the fairground. I knock out one addiction and another one pops up. And you know what? It's just say, oh, it's just another addiction? No, I got to seek it out, man. I got to find it. No, that ain't going to work. Anyway.
I like the saying in the rooms that we use everything that feels good until it feels bad.
Right.
And that's really kind of, I think, the essence of addiction is that inability to be comfortable, to have ease in my body and ease of spirit without having something external to put in me. And, you know, what I was thinking about, it talks about that the disease of addiction is threefold, that it's mental, physical, and spiritual. Mental's obsession, physical compulsion, spiritual self-centered. But there's this other component that I've found that is equally insidious and not talked about a whole lot in the rooms, and that is self-deception. And that's what every addict, that is how you maintain addiction. You can't stay. You can't hurt the people that you hurt. You can't hurt yourself the way you hurt yourself, and you can't do all the stuff that you need to do to sustain addiction unless you're able to lie to yourself. What the fourth step is, it is reversing that process. It is the reckoning. It is coming into terms with who I am and what I've done in my life. It's only then. Fritz Perls, the founder of Gestalt, said nothing changes till it becomes what it is. And the fourth step is your addiction becoming what the hell it is. And you coming to acceptance that this is what I've done. With that, I can now start the process of healing it, of making the restitution and coming to self-acceptance that I am flawed and that I'm broken and that I need help from other people. But I can't get there unless I come to full head-on facing of the things that I've done.
You know, on one of the greeting cards I did, it was directed toward the fourth step when I wrote it. And it says, we must face the dragon to become the butterfly. Until we look at all those lies, and they're lies that we tell ourselves about ourselves, not only about ourselves, we tell ourselves lies about the world, about life, about everything. Everything is predicated as a deception, to tag on to you there. But until we look at it, we don't see the lie of it. And we don't look at it. It's not like all of a sudden, oh, wow, there that is. It's like, for me, I had to dig. I had to dig to find out those lies were lies. And in finding that, I got to peel away lie after lie until all of a sudden, behind all those lies, oh, there's Johnny. I was working with a young lady the other day. God, love her, man. She has told herself so many lies, and she has been told so many lies. I told her the other day, I said, you know what you're really the most afraid of? And this is what I really believe is so for all of us. I'm not even going to say most of us. We're really afraid of that truth of who we really are, the love that we are, the joy, the bliss. We're afraid of that because we don't know how to trust it. And especially coming back into our very first show, Eric, if we've been traumatized, no, believing that is like, no. What, I'm good? I'm a good person? I told the girl the other day, I said, what you're afraid of is the fact that you are loved, loving, and lovable. Because you don't have any evidence for that. You have never found any evidence in your life that says that's the truth. So part of what we're going to do is I'm working with you as we're moving forward is we're going to start looking for the evidence that says, you know what? I'm a good person.
Amen from the choir.
Good. I love when you agree with me, Eric.
I almost always do, Johnny. I almost always do.
Yeah, it's a good thing, man. And I'm telling you, it's amazing to me the more I do shows like this, these shows I do with you and with other people and the stuff, how more and more just keeps being revealed to me. I love that one of the things I've learned in my journey is that I need to always be open to the idea that what I think is real could be wrong. Because in that place, I'm always open to learning. And it's an exciting journey then. It's like, oh, wow, I believed that for 15 years. Well, okay, after 15 years, I found out, you know what? It's wrong. It's not, and really, I don't like the word wrong. One of the things I've always loved about A Course in Miracles, I don't even know if the word wrong is in the book. But what it has us do is it has us, it directs us toward, does that serve my higher good? It either does or it doesn't. If it doesn't, I need to let it go and replace it with something that does serve my best interest. I never knew how to do that, man. What do you mean? I'll never forget my first sponsor told me, you're going to love this because you know who I'm talking about. He told me, he said, whatever your first instinct is to anything, do something else. Because your first instinct is always self-destruction. So then I went to work with him, for about 6 months. And one day at lunch, he says, you know, I've gotten to know you a little better now. And he says, you remember that conversation where I told you about your first instinct? He said, yeah. He said, well, now that I know you, whatever your first 10 instincts are, do something else, man. He said, you love to hurt yourself. And I didn't know that, but it was true. It was true. And thank God for honesty, because you can't get there if you're consumed with self-deception. You just can't.
I 100% agree.
That's why I tell somebody when they come to me, if you're not going to be honest with me, I can't help you, because the dishonesty that you embroiled yourself in is going to be like me trying to help you with a comic book. So it's got to start with honesty, man.
I remember writing parts on my four-step and getting into the description of the things and then writing down the insight that the whole thing was a lie. I had been telling myself these things that I did that were just fantasy, that weren't even real. And it wasn't until I wrote them that I got that how much I lied to myself. I didn't have any awareness that a lot of my history was fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, coming to terms with I'm not as bad or as good as I thought I was.
Right.
Well, that's what the four step does, is it balances perception. You know, it gives us the clarity to see ourselves as we really are. And we, it's kind of like addiction is a form of narcissism. You know, it's all self-serving. It's all about self-obsession. And what we do is that we gnarl up our beliefs about ourselves so that we can live with ourselves. And so we just tell ourselves and everybody else lies because we think that we got to be liked and that we need to exploit people to get what we need. You know, it's all about survival. It's desperation, as you said earlier. But as we complete the fourth step and get to the other side of that, there is that reckoning of where we have to settle into dealing with ourselves as we are rather than who we think we should be or who we thought we were.
Right. You know? Or even who we want to be.
Yep. Which is a beautiful thing to happen. It's just never very pleasant.
I know I've said this before on the show, and I'll keep saying it because it's so real for me. It's kind of like that part where the caterpillar goes into the cocoon and comes out a butterfly. That's when we face our dark night of the soul, is in the fourth step. And if we don't face that, we don't get to be the butterfly. If we don't go into the cocoon, we don't get to be the butterfly. And the irony of it all is we were the butterfly all along. Another lady I love, she helped me so much in my own healing, and I did a podcast with her a while back. She talks about how we were hypnotized as children with lies, and that a big part of our recovery is about peeling away and finding out what was hypnotization and what was real. For me, I was hypnotized about everything, man. Everything in my life was a lie. I got a brother that died before I was born. I've been told 8 different stories as to how that kid died. I don't know to this day how he died. So my family lived on those lies. That was just one little example. It was everything. I've been told my great-grandmother was full-blooded Cherokee Indian. She may not even been in America. I don't know. It's about sorting it out. And I think that's where the third step gives us the courage.
Amen.
The third step gives us the courage to be able to face the truth.
I would take that baton and carry it a little bit further.
Okay.
And say that the completion of the fourth step is evidence that you have a third step.
Right. Yes.
You're not operationalizing the faith of the decision to turn your will and your life over until you use that faith to be able to confront yourself.
Well, it's so amazing you say that way, because something I've said forever, I don't know when I started saying this, a decision is not really a decision until an action has been taken. Prior to taking an action on the decision, it's just a damned idea. Now, how do I show myself that I've made the decision in the third step to turn it over? I'm writing my fourth step. I start writing my fourth step, that's the decision. That shows me that I actually made a decision. I just didn't think, oh, wow, that's a good idea. It's like, okay, I can do this now. So now I'm going to decide to move on.
I like, too, that process of writing the fourth step, because not everybody, but, you know, I've sponsored scores of men in 30 years and a handful of women, and walked with them through the fourth and fifth step process. And it's not everyone, but a majority, 80%, the way they do the fourth step is they write a bunch of it, you know, a goodly chunk of it, and then stop writing it. And it's avoided for a while. And what happens is it gets so painful that the person cannot continue to stay clean, stay sober, without writing that step. That they reach the threshold of whether they're either going to die, kill themselves, literally, relapse, or surrender to the program. And, you know, I wrote a 300-page fourth step, my first one. And I wrote, it took me 10 months and 22 days to write that fourth step. And it took me 10 months and 21 days to write 150 pages. It took me one day to write the second 150 pages because I just reached that place where I needed to get it done, where I couldn't stand to be wallowing in that anymore. And, you know, that was a miracle in my recovery. And I immediately shared it with my sponsor, and I got relief from myself as a result of completing that four step. It was, you know, I look back on that and it's really the first ordeal of my life, spiritual ordeal that I completed, that I followed through to the end. It set up a new frame of reference that I can walk through hardship and get to the other side. I couldn't do that when I came in the rooms. I could not walk all the way through hardship. I found an excuse to bail on it.
One of my sponsors along the way told me that I was an incredible 8-inning ball player.
Incredible what?
8-inning ball player. He said, Johnny, you play a great game right up to the 8th inning. And then you'll go get a soda. You know, it became a big deal for me to see things through. A big deal. When I started writing my book, Dragons and Butterflies, which is why I get to have this podcast, I made a commitment to myself. I was sticking with it to the end. And it was kind of like what you said about your writing your fourth step, because my book is my story. I wrote 22 chapters in 9 weeks because once I started, I could not stop. It was like I'd popped a head on a big pimple and it just had to come out, man. And I couldn't stop, seriously. But the freedom that has come for me as a result of facing the truth of me, it's freeing. It's incredibly freeing. It's like all of a sudden, it's like I don't have to hide. It's such a great gift to be okay with being Johnny Calloway. I don't have to try to act or do or be like Eric Gentry or like my first sponsor, my last sponsor. I don't have to. No, I get to be me. All the warts, all the things, it's like I just get to be me. Wow.
And I don't know if there is a better articulation of the antidote to shame than what you just said there. That is the diametric opposite. It is 180-degree opposite of shame, is self-acceptance.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what you just described, is self-acceptance.
Well, and that's, you know, that's why I say the hidden benefits of the fourth step and why I talk so much in that one blog I did. Because, man, peace comes from that. Peace of mind comes from that. I don't have that war going on in my head. Because when you're you and you're trying to be somebody else, there's a war going on there. There's an incredible conflict happening there. And the sad part for me today is the me that I was trying not to be was really a pretty good guy.
Uh-huh.
So it's just mind-boggling to me. It can be a real challenge getting that message over to the guy that's just beginning on this journey. You say, what I have to do is like, you know what, in this area, it would really behoove you just to trust and move forward in blind faith. Because what's on the other side of this for you, I can't even describe it to you. So just know that whatever you come out of this with is better than what you got right now.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Beautiful. Go ahead.
I was thinking also about, you know, one of the things that's happening in the process of from the time that we hang up the chemicals until we write a four step is that we are for the first time functioning in a community, that we are sharing in meetings and we're being heard. And, you know, I've said this before, that I think that I shared myself into existence. That process of being able to come to meetings early in recovery and just share about what my day was. I remember that the way that I didn't get high early in my recovery was I thought about how I was going to share it in the meeting that night.
Mm.
I would rehearse all day long. Of course, I'd forget about it when it came meeting time, but all day long I was rehearsing about putting together these epic freaking shares that were going to, you know, everybody was going to just wow and knock their heads.
Whole room was going to levitate.
That's right.
Wow, can't wait till Johnny shares so we get going here. Yeah. Yeah. I can relate, by the way.
So think about how opposite that is to addiction, because addiction's hiding in that. In addiction, you have to be deceptive. You have to be manipulative. So you're always chameleoning and you're watching other people and you're figuring out about how to work them and gain from them. And that's the adaptation of addiction, is a hyper focus on everybody else. As we start spending time sharing honestly, you know, the fellowship I go to says that honest sharing is the antidote to our diseased thinking. And I think that's a pretty accurate psychological principle, you know, not just for addiction, but when we get honest with ourselves and we bring that forth and let other people hear us share what's true for us, and they nod their head and we make eye contact, there starts to be something other than addiction in our lives. There starts to be this foundation and connection of other human beings that I am having a kinship with. I am knowing that they're the same I am. And that kinship and that strength that they have gone through this process and they've done a four step. And A, not only are they not dead, they have what I want. And that is the motivation that allows me to walk into the place that I am most afraid of, which is to my own past. To walk into that and get honest about it and begin to confront all of the harmful things that I did to other people. And feeling that and feeling that, you know, I felt shame that morphed into sadness and irritation and a lot of, you know, it was feeling central doing a four step. But what was happening was that I was desensitizing and leaving that shit in the past, because that's what it does when we turn it into a narrative, when we get it written. Now it is memory instead of something that is encroaching, intruding upon our daily lives today. And the result of that means I can wake up and walk out my door and I can look you in the freaking eye instead of being so ashamed of myself that I have to divert my gaze. Wow. And that is maybe the most beneficial thing that comes from the fourth step.
I'm going to say amen to that. And then I'm going to say, I think that is an incredible segue to the fifth step, because, you know, we talked in the second step a lot about the connection and getting connected, giving us hope. But that is so magnified was for me with the fifth step, because now I'm sitting in front of another human being that's basically sitting there going, yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, me too. What, that's all you did? So the fifth step is admitted to God ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. In that place, that door that we opened in the fourth step just gets blown off the hinges. Because,
that's right.
I mean, it just gets blown off the hinges. Because now I've got another human being and God I'm sitting with. And we're like, okay. You know, I'll never forget. And that part, you know, that you were talking about earlier about in the fourth step about how we want to think we're either the worst or the best. And to me, that's part of the tactic of the diseased part of the mind. It's a tactic. It's like, oh, I can't tell. I did this fist step with this kid one time, and he was absolutely terrified of the sex inventory. And finally, he said, okay, I'm going to do it anyway. So we do his fist step, and we're done. And when we got done, he's sitting there, and he's looking at me, and he's all paranoid looking. I said, well, what about that thing you didn't want to tell me? He said, I told you. And it was nothing. Seriously, it was nothing. It was no more than a young boy exploring his sexual being. That was it. But in his mind, his disease had made it this huge thing that he should be crucified for. But when I told him part of my story that connected to that, I thought he was going to call the law on me. But the thing is, it's like when we take the courage from the third step and we take all of the hope of the fourth step and all of that, and we move into the fifth step, we become, in my mind, that's where I really start to become a part of not just a 12-step program, but of the human race. That's where I start to see, you know what? I'm just another bozo on the bus.
That's right.
I'm not the best bozo. I'm not the worst bozo. I'm just another bozo on the bus. Then I can be a part of the world that is so much bigger than me.
That's what I was trying to share earlier, is that I, before the fourth step, I have so much shame that I am, even in the rooms, I am still isolated. I still am holding, before my first four step, I still held the belief that I was different than you, that I was terminally unique. And while this might work for you, I was so bad that while I'm going to go through the processes, I don't think that there's any way it's going to work for me because of how evil I was.
Right.
And with the completion of the fifth step, that dissolved, and I became part of the we. And an addict becoming part of the we is at the intersection of where God is present. That is the miracle of where an addict can become, can lose the self, become anonymous as part of the we that supports other people healing. That is the miraculous occurrence. And it happens in the meetings, every meeting a lot of us go to.
Right. And it is miraculous. It's incredible. It's
miraculous.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. To me, it rates right up there with walking on water, you know, because if you think about it, the courage that it takes to reveal the truth of you to another human being. I can't swim a lick. But I'm telling you, that was as frightful for me as stepping out of a boat onto the water. Because it's like, you really don't know at that point, you don't know what you're stepping into. Hopefully, you've had enough of listening to other people that have done it that you're like, okay, well, Eric did this. Okay, well, Ed did this. And look at them now. They are who I want to be. They are what I want to become. And they say that the way they got there was to step out of this boat and put their toes in the water. So I'm like, all right, man, you know, you just reach a point where, again, it's like, you don't know what's out there, but hopefully through the honesty that hopefully you've been using up to this point is like, I don't know what's over there, but I know this sucks. So I really got nothing to lose.
My fifth step, I had on 6 legal pads. And I scheduled to do it with my sponsor, and we scheduled the whole day. And it turns out that the day that I went over, met him early in the morning, his wife was sick, and they had a 1-year-old baby. She's who's now just got married, and she's 30.
Wow.
He was on baby duty, and he had to go to the store. So I'm like riding in the car, going through the grocery store. We had to go to Lowe's, and I'm reading the 4-step to him. And just all day long, kind of going through that, just plowing through it. And we finished it up. I was living in Huntington, West Virginia at the time. We went down to the river, and I remember it was just a beautiful day. The sun was going down over the river. And the very last section in the guide that I used is on guilt and shame. And I remember the terror that I felt. It moves me right now, man. And looking in his face and seeing somebody loved me. And I knew I could share that stuff with him. Like, it was such a weird thing. I was terrified to do it, but I wanted so badly to not have to carry that stuff all by myself anymore. And I just was stuck there for a solid half an hour, not being able to get it out. And he just sat there with me quietly, and he looked at me and he nodded. And he shared about some of his stuff that he was ashamed of, and it was a lot of my same stuff. And you know, I got it all out, and he said he loved me. And, you know, and getting over that hump has given me the joy of getting to do that with other men, of where I get to hear and absorb that and then share back my experience, strength, and hope so that they understand what you're talking about with that kid, that they understand that they are not alone, that we have all done the same things. I've heard a lot of four steps, and they're all the same damn thing. Everyone, you know, we've all done the same things that we're all such so ashamed of, and it's really cool that we get that relief from ourselves and the just the prison that we have put ourselves into with our own self-judgment and damnation. It really is, last thing, I'll shut up after that, is, you know, you talk a lot about the Course. It really is the atonement at-one-ment. That's what happens in that fifth step, is that we are atoning and we are becoming one with ourselves, with our God, and with another human being.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I'm so glad you brought up the prison part of it, because one of the things I learned is, like, I did live in a prison. I never went, quote unquote, to prison. It wasn't because I didn't do some stuff that where I could have. I just didn't go. But I lived in a prison.
A felony every day.
Yeah, I lived in a prison. And what I found out at the end of all of that was I was the warden. I was the one that held the key in the way out. I mean, granted, other people had to show me, okay, if you put this key in this keyhole, this door will open. I had to have people tell me that. But the key was really my willingness to look. Because if you don't have that willingness, accompanied with that honesty and with the open-mindedness that we talk about, if you have those three things, the world is wide open to you. I can't believe my life today. I can't. I mean, getting to be here with you, what we do, one of these about every 6 weeks?
Yep.
And man, this is living for me. This is when I get to do these things with somebody that I really connect with, the way you and I connect, I am alive, because I'm talking about something that means something to me. And it's like, I'm not talking about, well, you know, Bobby's got the good shit down on the corner there. Go down, you know, three blocks. He's got, yeah, you know, and if you catch him at the right time of day, he may even cut you some kind of deal. No, we have conversations. We have conversations that, as you just experienced, touch my soul. And in that place, I get to be alive. You know, I've said 1,000 times, the 12 steps didn't save my life. What I had wasn't a life. What I had before I got in the 12 steps was a damned existence. What the 12 steps did was they allowed me to live. They allow me to live as I continue. And for me, on the personal note of that, when I reached the place where I joined the 12 steps with what I've learned since, from A Course in Miracles and the spirituality of it, it's like my world began to make sense. And prior, nothing made sense to me. Nothing. It used to drive me crazy when I'd ask somebody a spiritual question. They'd say, oh, don't worry about it. There is no answer for that. That's just the way it is. I'm like, no. No, there's an answer. Just because you don't know what the answer is doesn't mean there's not an answer. And I don't pretend to have all the answers, not at all. But I still believe there's answers. I just have to be willing to keep digging, and I have to be willing to be wrong.
I can tell you a whole lot of my academic pursuits, and, you know, all the way up to the doctorate level, has been in part for me to understand how and why the 12 steps work. And while I can explain it, you know, Jung, I've talked about him here on the show before. Carl Jung said, you know, if I want to sound like a scientist and talk in scientific language, I call that thing the unconscious. But if I want to turn it into a drama of which I am living in the middle of it, then the only right name for that thing is God.
Wow.
And that's what I can explain to you how and why the 12 steps work through the lens of behavioral and physiological science, and why and how it does what it does. But I can't explain to you the way all of that came together and has organized into its own thing to be a structured program built by and for drug addicts, other than to say it was God-given.
Yeah. You know, people want to debate with me sometimes when I say that the Course in Miracles was written by Jesus, that he dictated it to Helen Schuckman. And I'm like, if you read it and you begin to understand it, you won't have to question that anymore, because it's obvious that our human mind couldn't have come up with that. Just like our human mind, without some divine intervention, couldn't have come up with the 12 steps. It's not possible. We got too many things, too many human characteristics that get in our way to be able to come up with something so perfected. I mean, we'd be like, oh, no. Well, you know how the history was for the 12 steps in AA and Carl Jung and Bill Wilson and Bob Smith. It was like, no, they had to be able to get out of the way and let the divine step in and say, these are your steps. That's why I still, to this day, what should I say? I chuckle when I hear somebody say the spiritual part of the program. I'm like, okay, can we back up and can you clear up for me what part of this is not spiritual? That's going to be a much simpler answer than you trying to tell me what part of it is spiritual. Let's cut to the chase and you tell me what part isn't spiritual, because I can't think of a part of it that's not spiritual. We got a lot of things going on today. You know, with my podcast, I hear a lot of talk about the treatment model is broken. And I do believe that the way that treatment is handled in quote unquote, most treatment facilities needs help. At the very least, it needs help. But that doesn't mean that the 12 steps need to be fixed. Doesn't mean that at all. No, doesn't mean that at all.
And I'll put here, to bring that back around to the four step, that process of actually writing the four step, of actually getting it all on paper, is a constant exercise in will not being enough. Like, I can't force my fourth step to get written. I had to surrender my fourth step to be written. I had to pray my way through my fourth step, because I got so aroused and so jacked up that I couldn't write anymore. And it was only through the seeking of spirit that I could calm down enough, have enough of a brain working, not need to get away because I was so jacked up from the writing that I couldn't write. That process of staying in there and getting all of that down on paper is just truly magic for an addict. It changes us.
Well, I can't agree more. And then to continue with the rest of the steps, in my mind, completes us. It's like, and again, I'm going to go back to the butterfly, man. I came into this whole thing just eating everything that got in my path. Just like the caterpillar, I'm eating it. It's mine. You no longer get to have any part of it. It's mine. And then coming around to surrendering to, I can't eat anymore. I just can't eat anymore. And then going into the dark night of the soul and facing the truth and finding out, you know what? This guy I've been running from, this Johnny Calloway that I have been running from, I've been hiding from, he ain't that bad. He really ain't that bad. And then to get to become, I still hesitate to call myself the butterfly, because I think of a butterfly as a completed piece of art. I'm not completed. I'm still in the process. And I think we are until we're no longer here. But the thing is, I am at a place in that evolution, in that metamorphosis of being able to become the giver. And now then all that stuff I took can be used for good. I do not, there's a thing in Alcoholics Anonymous in the section called The Promises after the ninth step, where it says, not regret the past and wish to shut the door on it. I don't regret the past, because there's no part of my past that I have not been able to use to help another soul. No part of it. No matter how dark I thought it was, no matter how bad I thought it was, I have been able, somebody has shown up in my life in the last 34 years of being in this program, in these programs, and said, man, I did this. And I'm like, yeah, you're not alone. I did that. And look at my life today. Not like I'm not the CEO of some big company. I'm just a guy. I'm still just a guy. I'm still just another bozo on the bus. But I'm a happy bozo on the bus. I'm a contented bozo on the bus. And I love that.
Me too. And it's taken every one of those experiences back there to get me here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Richard Bach said in Illusions, you've lived your entire life for this moment.
For this moment, yeah.
Was it worth it? Was it worth it? I have a resounding hell yes that is followed with a whisper that says, doesn't mean I want to do it again. There's so much of that shit that I don't want to do again, but I'm so grateful it's a part of my path.
Yep.
But I ain't signing up to do it again.
Me either.
You know, just a little side note, something I heard in a 12-step meeting one time that I laughed my ass off, and I know you're going to relate to this. It was, you know how we periodically we have the topic of the yets that we haven't experienced yet? we were talking about the Yetts, and we're going around the room. We get to this one guy, and he said, "I'm not afraid of the Yetts, man. I'm afraid of the Agains." So, okay, guys, we'll have Eric back with us here in a few weeks, and we'll talk about a little more. We'll probably get a little more into the fifth step and talk hopefully about the sixth step. And we'll keep going until we get through to the end of this thing. And I want to say thank you. I want to say thanks to Eric. I want to say thanks to Kristen. I want to say thanks to the listeners. And Eric's going to give us another little thing about how to connect with him. But I also want you to know that I'm rebuilding. My website is under construction. And unless Eric says no, I'm going to have a link on there where you can go right to Eric's website and link up with him. Is that all right, Eric?
That's great.
Yeah, people will be able to link right up with you because, you know, Eric has given us a lot of information over the last year that's been incredibly helpful for all of us. So thank you, Eric, and tell us again where you can be found.
A couple of different places. AZ Trauma. I'm the co-owner and vice president of the Arizona Trauma Institute, and it is AZ, like Arizona, trauma.org is that website. And the music website, if any of you are intrigued with want to listen to some recovery music, is www.cleanmusic.com.
Thank you, Eric. And I have a tendency to forget this. Please go to Amazon and pick up a copy of Dragons and Butterflies. And also, I got two new books coming out in July, The Bridge and Taming the Dragon. Keep an eye out for those and come back next week for another show. Thank you very much. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Remember, never give up. Always keep it real and take time to smell the roses. And please sit down and watch a butterfly. Keep up with all that we are doing by going to morphintoanewyou.com. Thank you very much.